Welcome back to Rooted Wisdom. Today's guest is Dr. Christy Poitra, a former academic turned specialty crop farmer in the Great Lakes region. She is a first-generation descendant of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and she's traded lecture halls for lush fields, cultivating not just crops, but community, culture, and connection. From woodchucks in the tobacco beds to trailer hitch battles with tree stumps, this episode is packed with earthy adventures, deep wisdom, and a whole lot of heart. Let's dig in.
Hi, Dr. Poitra. Thank you for joining us today. Could you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am a specialty crop farmer in the Great Lakes region. I am a first-generation descendant of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and yeah, that's me.
That's awesome. So I know, but maybe our audience doesn't know, that you were first in academia before you became a specialty crop farmer. What inspired your decision to leave academia and pursue full-time farming?
There's the short answer, which is, you know, I was at a period of transition in my career. Where I wanted something different. I wanted to try something different. And I had the privilege to try something different. But the sort of longer, more in-depth answer is, you know, I've always been around plants since I was a kid. My mom is incredible at propagating things. She can propagate a plant out of thin air. It's incredible. And so I always, in my childhood, had plants very present. And I always had this interest, you know, when I would go do field work in my academic job, you know, I always had a camera on me. I was always taking pictures of plants. And so it was always just kind of a present thing. And then, you know, when I had found myself at this period of a transition from my academic career, you know, that sort of backdrop, particularly during the pandemic, you know, I had gotten back into indoor plants and, you know, that eventually spread to outdoor plants. And so, you know, I was just really engaged with the land. And then towards the sort of end of my time within academia, you know, my business partner and I, we ended up purchasing some land. And then we had to figure out what we were going to do with the land. And that's kind of how the farm was born, was really through that. So, yeah, so it was sort of a lifetime journey. But there was a definite moment where, you know, I had the option to return to academia or, you know, try something different. And I decided to pick the road less traveled, so to speak.
Yeah. So being that we work in agriculture, we know that there are always challenges that producers face. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced during your transition? And how did you overcome those?
Yeah, so some of the more tangible things are, you know, inheriting a barn is pretty awesome. When you don't have a barn and you have to build it, that adds a layer of complexity. So, you know, there was like the tangible, do I have the facilities to grow the things I want to grow? But there was also sort of the knowledge of, you know, how do you commercially grow, which is very different than gardening. And so there was a lot of sort of trial and error and learning just, you know, how to work with the land, how to work with plants. How do you do that in a way that isn't harming the soil? How do you do that in a way that utilizes water appropriately? So there was a very steep technical learning curve. And then there was also, you know, the practicalities of like, I don't have a barn to store my things in or, you know, cure my crops in. I would describe it as not necessarily challenges in a negative way, but sort of an exciting adventure of learning about things that, you know, I really had very little knowledge about. You know, thinking about like how do we design these spaces. It's not just that we have access to solar. It's more of how do we consume less? You know what I mean? How do we use our energy efficiently that's available from the sun? And so that includes, you know, how do we place windows? What orientation is the building? And then what are you going to use the building for? Are you going to use it in the morning? Are you going to use it in the late afternoon? And you know, how can you also use building orientation and surrounding vegetation to regulate the temperature within the building? And so those are all sort of deeply rooted in indigenous knowledge system in various ways, as you were kind of sharing me with your work.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I see these very cool buildings that they're building in, like, some different countries where they've completely encapsulated the outside with moss, because that really does help regulate that temperature. It helps them use less energy. And then also, there's something so deep in our core about being around things that are green. And so having that extra, like, green that people can see, where it's not just, you know, concrete buildings and those kinds of things, I think also helps heal our insides, not just the land.
Truly, in making this transition, I, at the point that I was sort of making this career transition, the land I credit is what kind of healed me in this process of, you know, choosing a different path. And some of that is just being present with greenery,
yeah,
know, getting to see it and being outside and hearing birds. You know, I read a study that was talking about, you know, humans hearing birds, like, lowers blood pressure and, you know, has some health outcomes and things like that. And it's where, you know, there's a lot of years of evolution that we're wired to associate, you know, certain things with certain things. And it we're wired for outside and
yeah,
to see plants and to see greens. And, you know, I read something that was talking about, like, the human eye's ability to see different variations of green and things like that. And I mean, it's interesting if you kind of dig into the science end of it.
Well, even in my my space of education, humans learn best outside, quickly, and in danger. Well, you can't put your you can't put your students in danger necessarily, but, you know, I used to hold class outside because they really, like, retained a lot more of that, because they were, like, there is that healing and calming properties of just being, you know, with the land and with the outside.
It's interesting because, like, you know, in academia, you'll have academics talk about, you know, having, like, a relationship and intimacy with the land. And I think about how, you know, I walk that space regularly of our property. You know, I know it really well. I know where all the fallen logs are, and I know where all the things are, and I know where, you know, ground wasps are nesting and where not to go at certain times of year. And you just get really familiar with the space. And then when you see a different plant, you're like, what's that? You know,
yeah,
it, like, sticks out like a sore thumb, you know, and you're like,
yeah,
where'd you come from? I've never seen you. Yeah. Like, who are you?
Yeah, like having a new kid in class. They, like, they come and sit down and you're like, wait a minute. That's different.
Yeah, and I imagine how, you know, ancestors must have encountered that in their own sort of stewarding of land. You know, you're accustomed that, you know, certain things are certain colors at certain times of year. There's certain things present. And then you see something new and you're like, what is that? Who are you? You know, introduce yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I got to find out who you are. And yeah, I think when we heal land, you know, when we share seeds with the land, when we, you know, consciously spread seeds while walking in the woods, we heal a piece of ourselves. Because for me, there's something to be said. You know, I had seeded a wildflower area on our farm, and I used a commercial seed mix, and I had amended the commercial seed mix with some of my own, you know, things I was interested in seeing. And there's something to be said. I put that out in, I want to say, early to mid-February. You know, we had put the compost out and things like that for that seed bed. And to see, like, the cone flower blooming and things pop up, and to know, you know, I put that there. There's something very healing about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Were there any unexpected joys or discoveries in your first year of farming?
Honestly, just getting to be outside for long periods of time. And so you get familiar with the plants and the animals and sort of their schedules. So, like, for me, I know on the farm, it's fall when the yellowfinch is bouncing on the cone flower heads to pick out the seeds. And so, like, I had no idea when I first set out in farming, that finches bounced on cone flour and ate the seed. That just wasn't, it wasn't part of my professional life at all. That wasn't, I didn't have time to notice that. I didn't have a need to notice that. I think in those early years, it was really just noticing the land, noticing what the land had to share. And, you know, realizing that, you know, animals keep their schedules for things. They know when things are in bloom. They know when things go to seed. I like to think of them as tending to garden in the same way that I do. I had grown some ceremonial tobacco for my personal use. And I remember it was right before a thunderstorm was coming in the middle of the night. And, you know, I went outside to look at the thunderstorm coming in. And there was this woodchuck. And he was in my tobacco beds, and he was just sort of touching the tobacco, and he hadn't noticed me, you know, and I was like, what is that woodchuck doing? And so you learn interesting things about the land and about animals in just those early years, because you're approaching it as someone who doesn't know a lot yet. And right. So everything is like exciting.
Absolutely.
It's a totally new world. Everything's exciting. You don't really understand what's going on. And so you notice these things. And so I'm watching this woodchuck, you know, bat around these tobacco plants. I still don't know what he was doing. He didn't eat them. He didn't damage them, but he was in there. And I wonder, and I think about those tiny moments of what was that? I wonder, I don't understand, you know, and then usually I'll look it up later and be like, oh, okay. That's part of, you know, some other
pollinating or
something.
Yeah. So how did your identity as a first generation descendant of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa influence your vision for the farm?
So I definitely wanted a farm that wasn't just sort of focused on yield. For me, I want the land to remain healthy. And the way I interact with it, I want it to be, you know, in a good way, as I was taught. You know, my dad is a, you know, avid outdoorsman. He's a avid fly fisherman. And so I was really taught from a young age, you know, the connection between, you know, like the mayflies that hatch on the river and how you use those things to catch fish, and that it's important that the mayflies hatch. And, you know, that there's this whole sort of balance and connection among things within the land. And so I really wanted to honor that with the business. And part of that was sort of definitely stewarding, paying attention, you know, what plants are present on the land. Some of those plants are, you know, considered invasive. And so how do we include more relatives into the space? And so that was really the focus, was just stewarding and learning. It took a couple years, though, for us to really kind of like really understand just the land itself, you know, like what were the areas that needed to be tended to specifically with specific types of support, and, you know, what areas were more healthy. The farmland that we have is sort of mixed. So I have swamp, forest, grasslands. So it definitely has different personalities depending on what side of the property you're on. And so each of those areas have kind of different needs. They have different, you know, animals present and things like that. The kind of culture played an important role in shaping how I wanted to just interact with the space, care for the space.
Yeah, so stewardship is a huge part of traditional ecological knowledge. And how has that informed your crop selection and your land management?
So it's kind of a complicated thing because, you know, I started out and I wanted to grow, you know, one thing, and I realized, you know, some stuff is just not going to grow in a space. And so part of the adventure was kind of figuring out, okay, what grows in this area that makes sense for me, because I, you know, had a stance that I didn't want to use a lot of chemicals. That was just my personal choice, and culturally, you know, that's kind of where I stood on that. So that does change when you're commercially growing on what you can grow. And so my personal stance was I wanted plants that pollinators liked. I grow a lot of ornamentals. I have colleagues who are very committed to growing, you know, native plants from the area. I also grow native plants, but, you know, for me, as a grower, as a business, you know, unfortunately, you know, a business has to sell things that people are interested in. And so for me, I really kind of looked at what plants do pollinators like? What plants do, you know, feed birds with their seeds? And then I tried to pursue those plants.
Yeah, really trying to make sure that everything was like working together in an ecosystem as opposed to like working against it.
Yeah, to sort of round out kind of what were some of the native plants that are already growing on the property, you know, and how could I support those plants and enhance the ecosystem while also, you know, existing in the realities of what businesses within, you know, an American system.
So what advice would you give to other Indigenous people interested in starting a farm?
I would say taking time to be with the land is the first step, is to just sit and observe. Observe how the seasons change. Observe, you know, what animals are out in the morning versus what animals out at night. Yeah, I would just say be with the land is step one. And there's a lot of sort of scaffolding after that.
For sure. What role does community play in your farming journey, whether that be community with the land or community with other Indigenous people?
Yeah, so I would say there's a lot of community in farming. You have, you know, products that spoil very quickly, so you got to have a good community in order to literally move your products. I would say for me personally, I really enjoy bringing students out to the land. I think it's really fun. So I've brought in some, you know, Indigenous students and other folks out there just to hike around and kind of talk about some of the issues that we deal with in stewarding the land. I've also had the opportunity to bring out some, you know, Indigenous faculty and other faculty to kind of just do the same thing and just learn about, you know, what are the intersects between when you have a problem or when you have something that you're trying to solve or cultivate. You know, the sort of the complexity and the layers that go into it. And I think there's a lot of similarities between, you know, farming and other sort of careers. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all, you know, trying to move towards a way we want to go. And there's, you know, things that we encounter that, you know, can support, but also stifle progress. And so you gotta think critically on how you're going to navigate that. And so farming is a very creative field. You use various things to solve complex problems that you encounter all the time, whether that is, you know, figuring out how to fix a piece of equipment or, you know, how do you trap water on the property so that you can utilize it for irrigation. Just a lot of complex problems that you encounter that are, you know, strange.
Yeah. So, speaking of land stewardship, how has your understanding of stewardship evolved since you began farming and starting your farm?
I sort of always had an appreciation for the land longstanding because I had grown up in a rural area. You know, my parents had land. And so, you know, I had a sort of longstanding view of stewardship. But as an academic, as I sort of transitioned into being faculty and a university administrator, those knowledges were less relevant to me day to day. And when I engaged in my research where those things came up, it was all very theoretical. And so an example I would give is, you know, a lot of times we talk about in Indigenous studies and within the community, we talk about respect for plants. And I learned in farming, particularly when I was working with some of the more cultural plants, that respect is safety. So, you know, an example would be, you know, I grew this particular strand of tobacco and it's potent. And so if you don't handle it with the correct, you know, gloves and PPE at the correct time of day, i.e. respect, you could get a little bit sick. And so, you know, that was one thing I learned was, you know, the theory of, you know, being respectful versus the practicalities of being respectful were very different in land stewardship. And it was exciting to notice that difference and experience that difference. And I think that's part of the reason why I really try to bring people out to the farm is because I want to sort of help the theory along of like there's a practicality to this. Of like the practice of stewardship.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people don't understand that respect. And so, like, my husband is very allergic to poison ivy. And so he has to respect where that grows, whereas I didn't have that sort of respect for that plant because I'm not as allergic as he is. And so, you know, he's hyper aware of where it grows and what it looks like and those kinds of things. And for me, I didn't have to, but now I have more of a respect for that plant, knowing that, you know, he has to watch out, or else he gets what we call the plague arm, where he gets real swell up. Just being respectful of those plants. In what ways do you see farming as a form of activism or cultural preservation?
So I just want to revisit really quick about the poison ivy. We also have similar plants that will cause hives and things like that. And it's interesting because I, too, am less allergic, so I'm less reactive. And so I've learned to be more respectful of just not tracking it into the house because others can get it.
Yeah. Well, and I thought it was really cool. I learned from one of our Cherokee individuals that we work with about the plant that grows next to poison ivy that you can use as a healing. So since they grow together, you know, it kind of has a natural, like, immunity to it. And so when you squeeze it and put it on there, it actually pulls the oils out. And so that was cool to see how, like, even plants are in relationship with each other. And, you know, they're respecting each other.
Yeah. And we're just out here. We need to have the knowledge to be able to know those things. We have a grove of poison ivy that we've, because the birds really like the seeds of poison ivy. Mm. Although it's toxic for humans, it's animals really like it. And so we have a grove of it in the back of the property. I mean, it's everywhere. That's kind of what happens in disturbed soil.
Right.
And so, but the vines that we have are huge. They stretch, like, you know, 30 feet in the air. They're significant. So they wrap around, you know, a lot of the old growth trees on the property. And, you know, we've kind of arrived at it's a plant to be respected, and respect is, you know, be able to identify it, know that it grows as a vine attached to things. So you can, you know, tell by its unique hairs that it has, as it attaches to another plant, and you kind of just know, and that helps sort of, reduce contraction of a rash. Of just knowing and being able to identify it and being respectful.
Well, and I love that that symbiotic relationship, like that symbiosis in nature, and like Three Sisters style is what I always think of, is that beautiful symbiotic relationship of helping everything to grow at once. Are there any of those symbiotic relationships that you use on your farm to increase yield or anything like that?
I mean, definitely to reduce sprays for me is we have really dense and diverse plant communities. And the reason we have that, we sort of create sort of plant beds to harvest from. And those beds bloom various things that we harvest from throughout the year. And so we do less row cropping. We do have some row cropping, but we do less row cropping. And within those plant spaces, because it's sort of a relationship among plants, and those plants bring in certain insects, and those insects bring in certain birds, and sort of to keep insect damage down, we have those diverse plant beds. So we know that, you know, certain birds will eat certain invasive species that damage our crops. And so by having this, like, you know, diverse plant bed, we're able to kind of keep that down. And then we sort of account to sort of culturally on the farm, you know, our joke is everyone gets a cut. And so, you know, when we think about yield, we think about, you know, there is a percentage that the animals are going to take as our co-gardeners, and we accept that. And, you know, we try to manage it, you know, that it's a reasonable, you know, 10 to 15% rather than a 30, 40%. Yeah, the realities of farming is, you know, everyone's going to get their cut. So there's no point trying to stop it.
So how do you hope that your farm will impact future generations, both within your community and beyond?
So one major thing is I would hope that at the end of my career of working with the land, that I leave the land in a better condition than when I found it. That is a main thing for me. I want it to be healthy. And by healthy, for me, that means, you know, a diversity of plants that are attractive to animals and insects and, you know, a healthy ecosystem, you know, managing, you know, just how we treat the land and how we build on the land. You know, the types of things. My business partner is an engineer, a civil engineer. And so, you know, we think pretty deeply as we construct things on the land of how can we construct things to last, not just for us, but, you know, for whomever takes this over in the future. And so I think there's a lot of considerations around that of just being sustainable and thinking about how can we make this a better place.
What's one story from your farm that you feel encapsulates your journey so far or is like your favorite story about your farm?
So it was early on in farming and we were constructing our first structure that we were going to use to sort of dry and cure crops. So just a, you know, covered structure that, you know, would help us out when we harvested and we could put crops in there to sort of dry out and cure. And so we had to do the foundations. So this is early on and you know, we're working together to, you know, save money and being as farmers do, making it work. And so we had used a game trail and we cut that game trail into a road. And so we needed to bring like 5,000 pounds of concrete bags down this down this road that was once a game trail for deer.
Get the donkeys.
And so, yeah, we were a little crazy and we decided that we were gonna drive the trailer that we could make this, you know, and it was a very, very short road. So we were like, we can do this. And there was this stump in the middle of the road that we didn't pull. You know, we had just dropped this tree. It was a unhealthy tree. And so, you know, we dropped it and we didn't pull the stump. And so we proceed to take our trailer down with this and the trailer hitch gets caught on the stump with this 5,000 pounds of concrete. And mind you, this is the only road in, the only road out. So if we block this road, we're carrying the concrete.
Yeah, back. There's like no turnaround there, I'm
there's
sure.
No turning back. And I remember, you know, I stopped and I was like, let's put out some tobacco because this, I'm not sure we're going to be able to make this. So we stopped, we put out some tobacco and we're like, please help us get this concrete down this road. And the stump. So the trailer hitch catches on the stump. I see the back of the truck go into the air, completely into the air. And the wheels are spinning and, you know, I yell at the driver, punch it. And so they, you know, punch it and magically this truck, I don't know how it did it, but it got through, you know, and got over the stump and it, you know, like, it bent some of the, it damaged the trailer just a little bit. We did need a welder, but so we got this concrete in and magically this stump wasn't even bothered. It was just, you know, here we were, you know, driving this big machinery in and the strength of nature, you know, this stump was completely unbothered. It didn't even chip it, but it had, you know, done pretty good damage to our trailer. And, you know, we got the concrete off. Thankfully, we did not have to carry this. And we, you know, we got the foundation poured and all was fine. But I'll never forget that the back of the truck was just in the air. Nature was completely unbothered. We gave it our best shot, and you know, we were fortunate enough that the stump let us through. But
yeah,
you know, nature is unbothered by some of our best efforts.
Absolutely. So what's next for you and your farm? Any new projects or dreams on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, we're in the middle of constructing. We're finishing up a building, and then we will construct another building that will have a greenhouse attached. And so we'll be able to, you know, increase our production of what we can produce from seed in the greenhouse. So I'm pretty excited about that. That's been a few years in the making. And yeah, that's pretty much the main thing. And just kind of, you know, tending to spaces. Our big dream is we want to have a series of retention ponds throughout the property and utilize sort of natural water runoff when it rains into those ponds, and then be able to utilize that water for irrigation of crops. So that's kind of our sort of long-term goal is, you know, stormwater management. And then our shorter term next few years goal is to, you know, expand our greenhouses so we can expand our season for 2 months before and kind of 2 months after, because up here it can get pretty cold.
Well, is there any piece of advice that you'd like to leave for those listening about farming and land stewardship and those kinds of things?
I would say we all kind of have our role, I think, in this ecosystem. Everyone plays a role, every animal and every insect, and we do too. And engage with the land when you can. Sometimes your role can be as simple as I walked on a trail and helped this native plant spread its seed in the fall. And it can be as simple as, you know, planting some things in your garden or learning a little bit about overwintering seed and things like that. Of just being a more active participant, I think, with the land, even if that isn't your job, but just as, you know, like a healthy sort of relative that's part of this space. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate you joining us for this episode of Rooted Wisdom, and we can't wait to see what else your farm does.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was really fun. I'm glad we could sit down and chat.
That's a wrap on this episode of Rooted Wisdom. A huge thanks to Dr. Poitra for sharing her journey from academia to agriculture, and reminding us that stewardship starts with observation, respect, and a little bit of grit. Whether it's those bouncing finches, some ceremonial tobacco, or building greenhouses and stormwater dreams, her farm is a living story of resilience and reciprocity. Until next time, stay rooted in wisdom.